Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the most important battle spaces in that war, of course, we will be talking about at length in the course of this program, as we do most days, Communist China. What is generally not well understood about that war and the threat that we are facing in it from Communist China is the extent to which we in the United States have actually been underwriting the threat from that enemy. A man who has been doing extraordinarily important work, exhuming information about that practice of particularly Wall Street, financing the Chinese Communist Party's malevolent companies, some of which are even building weapons with which to attack us, is an extraordinary patriot, a longtime friend, close colleague, and much admired contributor to public policy, both as a former senior director for international economic affairs on the Reagan National Security Council, and these days, in his two hats, the president and founder of RWR Advisory Group, and in the capacity with which we're speaking to him today, as the chairman of an institution he founded in Prague, the Prague Security Studies Institute. His name is Roger Robinson. Roger, it's so good to have you. Thank you for taking a few minutes to just catch up on what you've been learning about this thrift savings plan campaign to join the Wall Street legions who are financing our enemies in Beijing.
Well, thank you, Frank. No, it's very disturbing indeed. I mean, we have not been screening our capital markets for the 25 or 30 years that the Chinese have been flooding into our markets, both for stocks and bonds. And as a consequence, we have no idea of the kind of companies that have been entering our markets. As you mentioned, there are disturbing corporate bad actors among them. Some even advanced weapons manufacturers that are affiliated with the People's Liberation Army. Others are enabling egregious human rights abuses, such as the surveillance cameras for the concentration camps in Xinjiang, holding 1.5 million Uyghurs, and the list goes on. I mean, these companies, some of them are even sanctioned by the United States. And so we have this untreated disease, in a sense, a virus of a kind that has penetrated the portfolios of 160 million or more unwitting American investors and taken out of our markets maybe as much as $2 to $3 trillion so far. No one's exactly sure, with the intention of taking another $2 to $3 trillion in the next 36 months. And unfortunately, this problem of an untreated set of companies from our principal adversary have now threatened to penetrate the federal thrift savings plan of the United States. That is the retirement system, the 401k equivalent for 5.8 million federal employees. This is a $700 billion fund, and it too is now more than toying. It is imminently going to move the money, if they have their way, 50 billion of it, to in the so-called international fund, to an index, a stock index called the MSCI All Country World Ex-US Index, that is replete with these Chinese and Russian bad actors. So this is the nub of the problem, and it's much bigger than just the thrift savings plan.
It is indeed. The question that has arisen, thanks in no small measure to your very significant alarm raising, Roger Robinson, and I want to thank you in particular for that you've done in connection with some of the reviews of all of this by the Committee on the Present Danger China, is the possibility that President Trump will intervene to prevent these sorts of companies and Chinese military, industrial, and human rights related activities from getting access to the funding of, well, the retirement savings of men and women in uniform, as you say, and their civilian counterparts in the federal government, past and present. Will the president intervene as you see it? And if so, what should he be doing to try to prevent this egregious, outrageous thing from taking place?
Well, fortunately, Frank, even though the movement of this $50 billion I fund, as it's called, as part of the Thrift Savings Plan, is imminent, namely weeks away, if we're lucky, the president has become alert to this. I think that there is some concern that he might have been shielded from the full force of this development and understanding it in its starkest terms. There are those that would prefer this to go forward on Wall Street's behalf, as well as to maintain stable and happy relations with Beijing despite the coronavirus. That said, the president seems to be alert to it now. I think he's determined to stop it. I think he's ordered his staff to find the modalities to do so. And one of them certainly is that he can replace these five Obama-era appointees to what's called the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board, who have ginned up this wrong-headed and tragic idea, and in effect fire these five, replace them, which he's tried to do in three of those appointees just Monday of this week. And so we are hopefully on the path of seeing this decision overturned, but it's so near term that it may require an executive order by the president to freeze those funds while he's making this very much needed adjustment to the board itself that administers the federal thrift savings plan. So this is a race. And the question is, how will it play out? I mean, can you get Senate confirmation for these three individuals, a majority needed to overturn the decision within this very limited time window? Or do you need an executive order just to freeze the frame and give us the time to do so? This is where the debate is right now as we're speaking. And we don't yet have that answer, but it's a very encouraging direction. For the first time in 9 months of watching this tragedy unfold, and seemingly nobody on the watch to protect the American federal employees.
And in turn, all of us as well, because this, if it were to go forward, would be a booster shot for the Chinese Communist Party at a moment when they are in some distress as a result of what they've done to all of us through this pandemic. And it would certainly, I think, be seen by Beijing, Roger Robinson, as a reward for having unleashed this pandemic upon us if they pull this off at this very moment. So again, I want to thank you for your work in raising awareness about this travesty and for your leadership in trying to ensure that the president is made aware of it, and that now, having made clear his opposition to this, that his direction is faithfully implemented by his own team, hopefully with the help of the United States Senate in confirming these three new appointments to the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board. I hope all of you folks will be following this closely. You can join a petition encouraging the president to intervene at presentdangerchina.org. Please check it out. And if you haven't already signed up, do so and bring it to the attention of your friends and family as well. Roger Robinson, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for your time today. Godspeed, my friend. Keep up the great work. Come back to us with updates if you would. Next up, we will speak with Gordon Chang. We'll take stock on what China's already up to, let alone if they're emboldened further, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are joined, as we have the very considerable privilege of being each week, by Gordon Chang. Gordon is, of course, a best-selling author, incessant contributor to the public policy debate about his particular area of expertise, namely Communist China and what it is up to. We have the privilege of talking with him about that and much more on a weekly basis, and we are profoundly grateful for it. We hope that in addition to checking out his books, The Coming Collapse of China, A Nuclear Showdown North Korea Takes on the World and Losing South Korea, you are also following him on Twitter at Gordon G. Chang, as well as, needless to say, following him here and at Fox and elsewhere. Gordon, it's so good to have you. Welcome back. Gordon, there's a lot to talk about. I guess I wanted to start by getting sort of your 30,000 foot level appreciation of what China is up to at the moment and how worrying it is as you see it.
We are now in the fifth month of what the Chinese call their wolf diplomacy. This is extremely provocative and belligerent statements and actions. So, for instance, since the middle of February, we've seen boat bumping and other incidents in the South China and East China Seas. They've been directed against Japan, Taiwan, Philippines, Indonesia, Vietnam, and even their friend Malaysia. We had a Chinese diplomat about three or so weeks ago actually say, and this is a diplomat, the ambassador to Kazakhstan, say that Kazakhstan was once part of China and that the Kazakhs want to be absorbed into the People's Republic. Neither of those statements is true. There's also been extremely aggressive diplomacy in Europe. China's ambassador to Paris was actually called in on the carpet for making some inappropriate comments about a domestic French matter. And there's been this barrage of hostile comments directed at President Trump and Secretary of State Pompeo. We've got to be concerned because there are voices in Beijing that are talking about invading Taiwan at this time. So we've got to deter Beijing from some very hostile and belligerent ambitions.
We do indeed. And what's particularly concerning to me is the stuff that's going on in terms of military capabilities that are being brought to bear here, not just chatter in the diplomatic channels, Gordon Chang. And I don't know if you're comfortable characterizing the status of Chinese forces in proximity to Taiwan. But as we see this increasing intensification of their threats to the island, is it your assessment, Gordon, that the Chinese are basically good to go if they do decide to launch an attack, that they could do so more or less from a standing start without the preparatory steps that we hopefully are monitoring closely to see if the bellicosity is now going to actually be operationalized in an invasion of the island of Taiwan?
China may be able to do that. We've got to assume that they could, largely because our forces in the area are crippled. We've got two carrier strike groups. Both of them are in port, the Ronald Reagan in Japan for regular maintenance, the Theodore Roosevelt in Guam, with more than 800 of its crew stricken with the coronavirus. I don't believe that we have moved another strike group to replace the Theodore Roosevelt. So we do have a few Arleigh Burke destroyers in the peripheral seas, but that's not enough to deter a determined Chinese action. We don't know to what extent coronavirus has affected the readiness in the People's Liberation Army, but we can't assume that they have been at the same state we are, because we are right now not in a position to field forces in an immediate time frame.
Speaking of which, let me ask you about one particular step that's been taken by the United States that caught me by surprise, I must say, and I fear can only be interpreted by the Chinese as an evidence of our backing away in the face of their aggressiveness, and that is the relocation from Guam back to the United States of, I believe it's a wing of B-52 bombers. There's a couple of B-1s that have been flown in on a temporary assignment there, but A, what do you think prompted that, Gordon Chang? And B, am I right that the Chinese are probably further emboldened by it?
Yeah, we've ended our continuous bomber presence at Anderson Air Force Base on Guam. And as you point out, though, there was a flight of B-1s that have been temporarily relocated to Anderson. But this, I think, is a product of two things. First of all, we are stretched, just generally. But also there's a feeling that Anderson is could be attacked with Chinese missiles. And so there is going to be a general pullback to make sure that we have forces that can survive a first Chinese attack. But I think China is emboldened by all of this, whatever the reasons for that move. We got to remember that Xi Jinping is a very different type of Chinese leader than his predecessors. He comes from the same mold as Mao Zedong, and Mao believed in putting his enemies on their back heels, even when China was in a weakened position. Mao's view was you attack everybody at the same time. That sounds ludicrous to us, but we have to just take Xi Jinping at his word.
Well, if you look at what has been done with what I really consider as a biological warfare attack on this country, whether it was literally one out of a biological warfare facility in Wuhan or not, the cumulative effects of this virus launched against us, as you mentioned, sidelining our military in Western Pacific, among other things, but also attacking everybody else in sort of a Maoist campaign. It's not hard to conclude that we're dealing with somebody who is, perhaps for social engineering purposes, perhaps just because he sees an opportunity, poised to move aggressively. And it raises a question. I wanted to also talk with you about an interesting response that was made Monday to what the Chinese are up to by Matthew Pottinger, who I would argue is probably the president's most knowledgeable and certainly most robust advisor on China as the deputy national security advisor. He made a speech. Gordon, I'd be interested in your take on the speech, its content, and its targeted audience.
Yeah, Pottinger, the deputy national security advisor, gave a speech in Mandarin. It was obviously directed to the Chinese people, and there is some evidence that it has been circulating around in China. This is really important because the thing that the Chinese hate most is when U.S. officials talk to the Chinese people, because Beijing right now is extremely insecure. They've got a lot of people who are upset about the way that Beijing handled the coronavirus epidemic. And also, you've got an economic standstill in China, and they're only starting to come back from it. So Beijing right now is devoting extraordinary efforts to controlling information. And Pottinger's speech was really something that pierced right through their great firewall. So they are extremely concerned. And it was a great speech, one of the best things the United States has done with regard to China, you could say, in a very, very, very long time.
I concur. I'm fascinated by the fact that it was given in what I'm told was flawless Mandarin and unaccented at that. And I have the feeling that that was not lost on his audience in China as evidence of the caliber of the speaker, as well as the content of the message being important for them to take aboard. Gordon, finally, let me just ask you quickly. We talked a little bit about Taiwan and its perilous position at the moment. An interesting development has been the contrast between how a democratic, free Chinese population, that's also Taiwanese population as well, of course, but Chinese are part of the population of Taiwan, contrasted so starkly with how the totalitarian communist regime of China dealt with this coronavirus. And this has given rise to a desire, it seems, on the part of lots of nations, including some that I believe are not formally, you know, recognizing Taiwan, that Taiwan ought to be part of the upcoming conversations within the rubric of the World Health Organization's annual meetings that it would otherwise be barred from doing by the Chinese and their insistence that they not be allowed to be in any international organization. Deconstruct that for us, if you would, and does this give rise to perhaps some new opportunities for a rallying of the international community to Taiwan's side at this critical moment?
The United States has been on a renewed diplomatic push to get Taiwan observer status in the World Health Assembly, which is the decision-making body for the World Health Organization. And the WHA actually has its next meeting, I think, the 17th or 18th of this month. And so this is a point where China is really trying to prevent Taiwan from being there. And the U.S. and its allies are working really hard to make sure that Taiwan gets that status. Taiwan in the past has had WHA observer status, but doesn't have it now. And I think that this is important for the U.S., apart from the issues of Taiwan being a model citizen. It really is a question of just showing China that we really don't care what they think, that we're not upset about, we're not afraid of angering them. And this is really the first step to a better Chinese diplomacy, a China diplomacy on our part, because we've got at the beginning to show that the United States is going to defend itself, its friends and its allies, and we're just not going to accede to what the Chinese want merely because they bark and they bluster.
We'll be watching this very closely, as I know will you, my friend Gordon Chang. Follow him at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter and, of course, on these programs each week. Gordon, thank you for your visit today. We'll look forward to talking with you again in the coming weeks. Next up, we will speak with Diana West. We'll do some dot connecting on what Bill Gates is up to in the midst of this pandemic and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and one of the features of this program is at hand, namely our weekly visits with Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist, a blogger par excellence at dianawest.net, the author of three, count them, three terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and The Red Thread, Search for Ideological Drivers in the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. Diana has been writing on a number of subjects of late that catch our eye, and it's always a delight to have a chance to visit with her at some length to discuss them. Diana, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Good to have you with us. The thing that I particularly cherish about our visits, Diana, and the work you do more generally is your excellent dot connecting. And I was struck by a piece that you had at dianawest.net the other day entitled Bill Gates Creep. And creep is a term that I think is useful in several different contexts when talking about Bill Gates. But I wanted in particular to just have you walk through what we know about Bill Gates, not his Microsoft saga and the fabulous wealth he's accumulated, or even really a lot of what he's done with his wealth through the Gates Foundation, but specifically what he has been doing with that money, with his foundation, and otherwise, that is quite, well, unsettling, to say the least, with respect to this pursuit of a vaccine program that has some medical elements to it, but also some societal control elements to it as well. So just give us a sense of who this guy is and the role he's playing at the moment.
Well, everyone knows who he is in the sense of being that billionaire philanthropist. Although I think what many of us who did not pay that much attention to him, shame on me, all these years, have looked at during this whole corona crisis is his role for many years, and certainly right up to the minute, in using his billions, using his infiltration through money and control of world health institutions to essentially promote an agenda of totalitarian style control of people through their own most personal system, which is their own health. And we see that when we look at, for example, the World Health Organization. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is, I believe, the second most generous donor to that organization after the United States. This is an extraordinary means of promoting an agenda that, as I've learned and been arguing for some time, if only on social media like Twitter, it is not really about our health and well-being. It is about control. And so when we look at the Gates press against what is known forever as herd immunity that comes about when a virus attacks a community at a certain point, the virus does die off and people are immune to it. And this is only by exposure. I mean, this is just the way people used to deal with these things. He has stated explicitly that he does not want healthy people walking around out there. In other words, he does not want to see herd immunity achieved, even though we may be achieving it by dint of how long the virus has been with us, longer than previously thought. And he is, in order to press for A, vaccine, which is his business, and B, this notion of digitizing our health records through not just even a smartphone identification like a passport, but also literally something stamped on us in a very high-tech fashion, a kind of high-tech tattoo that will essentially mark us as whether we are permitted to pass through life. I mean, this is where health is not any kind of anything more than a means to an end, which I have concluded is social control.
So let's just drill down a little bit on that. What I understand is that this digital tattoo, if you will, is something that now can be injected in a nano chip, an extraordinarily small chip, as part of the vaccine that would be given to people to ensure that they do not contract this disease. Now, it assumes that there is such a vaccine, but he's working hard on that. And what I hear you saying, Dinah West, is that Bill Gates, former, you know, founder and grand poobah of Microsoft, has now transformed himself into the driving force behind this idea that the world will be vaccinated and thereby embedded with this means of communicating to external sensors information about the individual as well as about their health that lend themselves to a kind of totalitarian control that's arguably unprecedented in the history of the world. Have I got that right?
Absolutely. And it's more than that when you realize in many ways he is the architect of this social calamity through lockdown, this economic attack, this attack on our economies, taking down of our economies and our way of life. When you realize that the computer modeling that was the rationale for this draconian measure of locking down the healthy, of putting us all effectively under house arrest all of these many weeks now, months now, comes out of computer modeling that is directly funded, or perhaps indirectly, but generously funded by Bill Gates, looking at the Imperial College London, funding also the University of Washington, which has the IMHE modeling coming out all the time wrong, grossly exaggerated, and so on, a Bill Gates project.
So on top of this, you also have, Dinah, just one other dot that I need you to connect is in October of last year, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation was among the sponsors of a program called Event 201 in New York City. Talk a little bit about that and how it fits into this larger, well, scheme, it would appear.
Yes, well, this was a very oddly timed tabletop plan for pandemic management, specifically coronavirus planning, that essentially forecasts much of what we have been living through. But, you know, it goes back even farther than that. This takes us off Bill Gates a bit to the Rockefeller Foundation, something his foundation emulates. Yes, another sponsor in 2010 was doing pandemic planning. There's a report people can read online that essentially describes the very draconian measures that we are living through, right down to face masks, temperature checks, and economic shutdown.
And the benefit, if I'm not mistaken, certainly of the 201 event, of the World Health Organization and global governance and means of generating more funding for all of that as a means of advancing, well, again, the larger agenda here.
And think about it, if you are beholden to some sort of digital immunity passport or digital tattoo, God forbid, think about the control that the government, these entities, these globalist entities have over the conduct of your life, of your education, of your jobs. I mean, this is something we've been looking at, China's imposition of these social credit regimes. Well, this is it in spades here, and if it actually comes into your body, it's it's permanent and it's horrifying. And, you know, I think many Americans, myself included, will go down fighting any such measure. I mean, that's just not happening. We start our own Our Bodies, Ourselves movement. I mean, this is absolute madness. But this is very close to reality. We're not reading a science fiction book or watching some crazy cartoon. And all of it is in plain sight and easily examined and opposed.
And Bill Gates is a driving force behind it. And just on your point about China, we are watching a similar kind of control being used, as you say, through the social credit system. They are, as I understand it, currently putting health information on the individual cell phones. And without the green pass on your cell phone, you are not going to be admitted to things or allowed to do things and so on. So this is not some dystopian, you know, nightmare of the future. This is something that is in the works right now. And Bill Gates's connivance with it and his support for it and his coercive pressure through his philanthropy is profoundly alarming, Diana, and I want to commend to our audience your excellent piece on the subject, dianawest.net. Hey, before I let you go, I did just want to quickly touch base. We're going to talk more about this with Sam Faddis in a moment, but as the author of The Red Thread about the anti-Trump conspiracy and its ideological drivers, just give us a quick update, Diana, as to what you make of the recent revelations about the takedown of Michael Flynn by some of those in the anti-Trump conspiracy.
Well, it's outrageous, and it underscores so much of what we already know. And in a way, I find much of this anticlimactic and in a strange warp zone, because we knew about this frame-up. We've known about it for years now. And it isn't so much that we need another breaking story or another piece of evidence, however locked down it makes the story. We need action, and we're not getting it. We're not getting it from the Justice Department. We're not getting it from the Attorney General. And, we're not getting a pardon for General Flynn. And I don't know why we have to keep breaking news. We need to start seeing, well, it would be nice. It would be a great thing if we actually started seeing the court system and the justice system and the prison system take up where they should.
Well, just a last point on that, Diana. I was very appreciative of Maria Bartiromo's aggressive questioning of Lindsey Graham the other day, Senator Graham, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, for his failure to conduct oversight, despite repeated promises to do it, of these various things that, as you say, we've known about. They've now been documented in various forms, but we've not had accountability. I pray that is forthcoming, but I know you'll stay on it until we get it. Diana West, thank you for your time today, as always, and your extraordinary dot connect. We're deeply grateful and look forward to talking with you again next week. Next up, we will speak with Sam Faddis about the Praetorian Guard that has tried to shape our politics. That is a subject of great concern to all of us who are fearful about elections and their future course. Stay tuned for more. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back and joined, as we have the privilege of being from time to time, by a good friend, a great American by the name of Charles Sam Faddis. He has a remarkable background. I could take the full segment introducing him properly, but suffice it to say, he served his country both in the uniform of the United States Army and out of uniform under deep cover as a Central Intelligence Agency operative. He finished up his 20 years at the agency working as the director of its Weapons of Mass Destruction Terrorism Directorate. He has been also involved in public life. He ran for Congress. He has been an assistant attorney general in Washington State. He is, in short, a man of many parts, and we're always thrilled to be able to catch up with him, especially to touch base on some important writing that he is doing at a wonderful online journal and magazine. Sam Faddis, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's good to have you. I wanted to talk first and foremost, Sam, about something you filed on the first at end, entitled The Praetorian guard. U.S. security officials decide who is fit to be president. We touched on this a little bit with Dinah West a moment ago, but give us your reading of what we have learned in recent days. Much of it, as she has said, has been out for some time, but we do have now additional documentation about the role of the FBI in the pursuit and ultimately the takedown of Mike Flynn as part of a larger conspiracy. Give us your reading on what we've learned and its import.
Well, I mean, in synopsis, the most recent information shows that, the Bureau and when I said the Bureau, I mean from Director Comey on down, Director Comey had his hands directly on this and admitted so. Send FBI agents into the White House all 4 days after the president had been inaugurated to meet with the newly minted National Security Advisor, General Flynn, who had been previously head of DIA under Barack Obama. They did it ostensibly because they wanted to answer him and to answer some questions about phone calls he'd had with the Russian ambassador, which they do their best to make sound nefarious, but of course this happens in Washington, D.C. every 5 minutes. That's what ambassadors do. They had already listened to the phone calls because, of course, the Russian ambassador's phones are monitored, so they knew every word that had transpired. They'd already closed the investigation once. They had already satisfied themselves, at least the people at the working level, that there was nothing remotely resembling a crime here, and yet not only were these agents sent into the White House to meet with Flynn, but we now know from notes that have been declassified that their explicit objective was one way or the other to destroy him. In fact, the question in the notes is, are we looking to get him fired or are we looking to prosecute him, as I'm paraphrasing. But so we, this is not really, I think, a revelation in a broader sense to most people that have been following this, but it's yet again just pushes our face into how nefarious this whole thing is. That 4 days into a new administration, the head of the FBI has set his sights on destroying and taking down the National Security Advisor.
Let me just ask you on that point, Sam Faddis. Why were they so intent on removing a man with Michael Flynn's background and skill sets, his distinguished record in combat, among other things, in the United States Army as a 3-star general, and then, as you say, his running of the Defense Intelligence Agency, or DIA. There was an animus here, clearly. What do you think prompted it?
Well, one of the theories that's been trotted out, and other folks have written on it, is that, okay, look, you have a brand new president who really doesn't know how Washington works. I mean, Donald Trump's a very bright guy and very accomplished, but he's coming into government cold. Here is the guy you just described, a former 3-star general who's the head of DIA, who knows the intelligence community backwards and forward. And if you're running an operation against the president, which in fact the company were, you might want to get Flynn out of there because he's your number one threat. He's the guy that's going to discover the coup. I think there's probably a lot of legitimacy to that. I think when you said animus, that's not an inconsequential factor. Flynn was fired by Barack Obama. He says because he criticized Obama's policies on a variety of things. Obama claims he was doing a horrible job at DIA. But in any event, Flynn ends up in the Trump campaign as an advisor, campaigning with the president, appearing at campaign rallies. So he's clearly gone off to the camp that all of these guys that we're talking about, the coup plotters, regard as the enemy. So there's probably just a lot of, in my mind, we're going to destroy this guy because he had the audacity to lash up with the president.
And I would argue also what he knew about the intelligence community would have portended not just the outing of the conspirators in the anti-Trump conspiracy, as Dinah West calls it, but also perhaps an awful lot of other rot in the intelligence community, which you've personally experienced and chronicled as well in your books. Let me ask you, switching gears, China is, of course, very much on people's minds. Back in April, you wrote a piece at End Magazine, which I think was also very much worth our revisiting and attention. You were talking about the Pelosis, Nancy Pelosi and her husband, and it's a cautionary tale, really, not just about their conduct vis-a-vis China, but more generally about the rot that has really caused us to be regarded, well, Michael Pillsbury said on Maria Bartiromo's show recently, that caused the Chinese Communist Party and its cohorts to laugh at us because we've been so completely corrupted that even in the face of their various provocative and insidious attacks on us over many years, we do nothing about it. Your take on the Pelosi's as a microcosm of that larger problem, as well as that bigger story as well.
Right. Well, I mean, what you have is you have Nancy Pelosi and her husband. Of course, Nancy Pelosi has gotten fabulously, fabulously wealthy in public office. And essentially the way this works is one way or the other, she uses her influence to help her husband's business. He does commercial real estate and investing. But if you dig into their businesses, what you find out is that this is all in her husband's name, but obviously it's Nancy as well. They are invested. They make huge amounts of money in China and have vast sums of money invested in China. They have bought completely into the communist regime. So she is a perfect example. I love your term rot. And when you talk about corruption, because that's exactly what it is. We have Americans like this all throughout our government and at the top levels of our industry who sold their souls for a buck. They sold their souls to the communist Chinese. You've seen this in recent days with people coming out, major industrialists coming out complaining. I mean, Bill Gates is at the top of this list, complaining that we're being too tough on the Chinese, basically. We have all these people who we think are supposed to be acting in America's interest. They're not on our side anymore. They're on Beijing's side in this fight.
Big time. Did you happen during your time at the Central Intelligence Agency to cross paths with this fellow Brian Dean Wright? I'm sure you know of him. He has been a public figure now for some time since he left the agency. And I caught him on Tucker Carlson's program probably 3 or 4 weeks ago now. When asked by Tucker about this rot, specifically with respect to the Democrats like Nancy Pelosi, he said something, and I'll paraphrase it here, to the effect that, well, there are basically three problems with the Democratic Party and its leadership. Either they're useful idiots, or they've got some sort of ties into the Communist Party of China, or they're actually agents of Chinese intelligence, the MSS, as it's called. I was really stunned by a guy who's not only a former agency officer, but also a self-described Democrat making such a pronouncement. And I have to say, I think there's examples of at least some of those categories on the Republican side of the aisle as well. But in your research into the Pelosi matter, I assume that you've arrived at similar conclusions, have you not?
Yeah, I think that's a perfect description. I mean, I'm not going to say that I have run across concrete evidence that Nancy Pelosi is a paid source for the Communist Party, but bought and paid for in that sense, without question. And she's one of innumerable such people. So as we're looking, you know, the American people have their eyes opened by the pandemic to reminded of the horror of what the Communist Party is and are really focused on, okay, look, we need to change course dramatically from what we've been doing for about 30 years now. And what we have to understand is some of the most powerful people in our country, quite a few of them, don't agree with that.
Sam Pattis, thank you very much for this insight, chilling as it is. We mustn't let it run that course, needless to say. And I commend to our audience once again Trevor Loudon's extremely persuasive documentation of what he calls the enemies within in connection with communists and others inside the wire of our government. Sam Pattis, thank you for your time today and for your great service to our country, past and present, as well as future. Keep it up, my friend. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.